Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies program titled Slavery, Conquest, and the Rise of the American College. Our speaker is Craig Wilder, professor of history at MIT. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, African American Studies program director John Thornton.
Professor Wilder has a PhD from Columbia and he's taught at Williams College in Dartmouth. He's the author of several books. The one I think he's going to probably be referencing today is his book, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. But he has some more before that one. He also did a book, actually quite an influential book, called In the Company of Black Men, that the African Influence on African-American Culture in New York City, and A Covenant with Color, Race and Social Power in Brooklyn. So I have to say that Professor Wilder has some interests in common with me. He's also been a talking head on documentaries a number of times. He probably had similar experiences to me in that. Like you talk for like an hour and they clip out five seconds and it's not what you meant to say anyway. But anyway, we have to deal with that. He's been in a number of documentaries. Central Park 5, which is probably the best known one that he was a part of. My Brooklyn, the Hook History Channel's FDR, A Presidency Revealed, and Rick Burns' PBS series New York, A Documentary History. He's also, another thing that's dear to my heart, he's worked with museums and with advising and even with directing sometimes museum exhibits. These have included exhibits at the Brooklyn Historical Society, the New York Historical Society, the Chicago Historical Museum, the Brooklyn Navy Yard, New York State Museum, and others. He's also, and I think Ms. Fizik will be interested in this, he's a senior fellow at the Bard Prison Initiative, where he has served in a variety of capacities. So with that, you don't want to hear from me. You want to hear from Professor Wilder.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I don't live that far away, so it's nice to find. And I've actually, I guess it's called cheating. I've kind of snuck in to use various of your facilities, including the library, from time to time. And so it's really great to be invited to talk. I'm going to do a slightly different version of the talk. In August 1797, shortly after the final term of his presidency, George Washington actually rode horseback to the Catholic College in Georgetown. Georgetown is a Maryland settlement that 6 years earlier had been ceded to the new federal government for creation of the federal district. In 1789, John Carroll had founded the college. Carroll was the nation's first Catholic bishop and an ex-Jesuit, just simply meaning that Pope Clement had suppressed the Society of Jesus in 1773. There were lots of ex-Jesuits, in fact, at Georgetown. President Louis Guillaume Valentin de Bourg and a small faculty of French and Creole Sulpician priests, the Order of Saint Sulpice, greeted the former president, along with former Jesuits from North America, England, Ireland, and continental Europe. Washington spoke to the faculty and a larger body of students from the porch of a new building, now Old North, the building on Georgetown campus where American presidents now sort of ritual and presidential candidates routinely go to deliver their message to Catholics in the United States. Enslaved people completed the scene. Slaves belonging to the faculty and officers and slaves owned or leased by from local craftsmen and merchants labored at Georgetown during its first decades. The vice president was in charge of overseeing campus slaves, and the records offer glimpses into the routineness of the business of overseeing slaves and servants. In 1793, the merchant Thomas Corcoran received, and I'm quoting, cash from one pair of shoes for Negro Nat. 2 years later, the officers paid, quoting again, cash for Negroes Joseph and Watt for 3 days' work. In December 1798, the board agreed to house, quote, four Negro children at $20 each with Margaret Medley in town. If Washington's visit to Georgetown confirmed the incorporation of the Catholic minority into the United States, then the presence of the college slaves captured the social forces binding the new nation. Georgetown was a product of the American, French, and Haitian revolutions. In fact, refugees of the Atlantic uprisings dominated the campus. and it was a beneficiary of the slave economies that excited this age of political transformation. Higher education in North America rose with the slave trade and evolved with the westward expansion of plantation slavery and the dependent rise of a manufacturing and banking economy in the northeastern cities. And the contradiction of the revolutionary era construction of hereditary freedom and hereditary slavery was perhaps most striking on college campuses. Washington also had financial links to the town and personal ties to the college. He was a founder of the Potomac Company, a commercial partnership that sought to develop Georgetown as what one historian has described as the gateway to the West, a Potomac River port, but situated in an inland spot that was the narrowest route across the Allegheny Mountains and into the sort of rich areas of the Mississippi and Ohio Valley. The college was a part of an array of properties that the Catholic clergy used to maintain and project the power of the Catholic Church in the new United States. African slavery had supported all of the Catholic ministry's spiritual labors in the British colonies, and it positioned the church to assert full membership in the nation. Bishop Carroll was a slave owner. He situated his college at the geographic center of national politics and an economic region that was vying for supremacy. The campus sat on a cliff overlooking an active tobacco port. Just months after the college was founded, George Washington was actually in Georgetown managing his investments. And a small group of Protestants had studied at the college during its first decade, including Washington's grandnephews, Bushrod and Augustine. Bushrod becomes a justice of the United States Supreme Court. The faculty and students had even visited the president at Mount Vernon and, in fact, exchanged letters with President Washington and Martha Washington. The crisis of the American Revolution had allowed Catholics to escape their status as a persecuted and despised minority, and the Atlantic slave economies facilitated their assimilation into the national citizenry. Of the possible years that the college could have chosen as their founding moment, Georgetown's governors eventually selected 1789, which is actually a relatively late date, making Georgetown quite weird, I should point out. Most colleges actually try to claim to be older than they are. The University of Pennsylvania, for anyone who knows it, has actually added a number of years to its founding date in the last 20 years. And so if you went there in the 1980s, I never went there, but if you went there in the 80s, you have sweatshirts that are just wrong now. They're now older than Princeton, they're older than Columbia, they've added 15 years, actually, to their age. But Georgetown actually chose a relatively late date, 1789. But it's actually an interesting one because it's concurrent with the ratification of the Constitution and the inauguration of George Washington. In other words, it's part of the Catholic claim to being in the United States. Quote, "It gives me pleasure to hear George Washington is chosen president," the Reverend John Fenwick wrote from the Catholic College in northern France to his cousin, the prominent tobacco merchant Ignatius Fenwick in Maryland. Quote, "He deserves that post to be sure if merit has any weight." Washington, in fact, George Washington, embodied the fragile compacts unifying a diverse nation. Early in his presidency, he sent assurances of religious liberty to Quakers, the Reformed Dutch, Episcopalians, and Presbyterians. He replied to a plea from the nation's Roman Catholics, signed by John Carroll, later the bishop, and several lay leaders, including the wealthy planter Charles Carroll of Carrollton. Charles Carroll of Carrollton and John Carroll are cousins through the Darnell family. And Charles Carroll of Carrollton, as I'll point out later, is the only Catholic to sign the Declaration of Independence. He responded to that Catholic plea with an affirmation of freedom of conscience and faith. A few months later, the president promised the Jews of Newport, Rhode Island, a government that, quote, "gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance." His response to Carroll also acknowledged the sacrifices of Catholics, domestic and foreign, during the Revolutionary War. I would argue, in fact, that it was more than the Catholic contributions to the war that allowed for the assimilation of Catholics into the United States. In late 1633, three English Jesuits, Fathers Andrew White, John Gravener, and Brother Thomas Gervais, set sail for Maryland aboard the Ark and the Dove. The ships landed first in Barbados, which had a small community of English and Irish Catholics. The captains then piloted the vessels through the Caribbean slave islands before venturing up the mainland coast to Virginia. On Lady Day in 1634, the Jesuits officiated the first Catholic Mass in Maryland. Four other Jesuits arrived that decade. Part of the rationale for the arrival of the Jesuits in the early 17th century was the evangelization of native people. And in fact, the rise of the American college and the evangelization of Native Americans were tied in American history. The early American colleges all reflexively claimed to be established in part to spread the gospel among the indigenous people of the Americas. Reverend White opened an Indian school near the Anacostia River. Father Roger Rigby ministered to the Piscataway in Virginia and translated the Catholic Catechism into their language. By 1640, the Jesuits had even developed plans for a Catholic college at St. Mary's, Maryland, to facilitate missionizing the Lenape, the Anacostia, the Nanticoke, the Susquehannock, the Powhatan, and other indigenous nations. Although Maryland was the most heavily Catholic of the English colonies and the only Catholic proprietorship, Catholics were never more than a tenth of its population. In 1637, the proprietors gave the Jesuits the St. Inigo's plantation. St. Inigo's is just St. Ignatius, in St. Mary's County. The order acquired additional holdings through grants and through trade with native communities. In 1649, the General Assembly of Maryland and Cecil Lord Baltimore instituted religious tolerance in the colony, a modest protection that survived only a few decades. Protestant failures at converting native people fueled resentments and fears of Catholics. During the English Civil Wars, authorities arrested Fathers White and Copley and deported them to England in chains. They hunted Roger Rigby, Bernard Hartwell, and John Cooper, all Jesuits, and brought them to Virginia where they died. Anti-Catholics gained strength during the Glorious Revolution, forcing the revocation of Baltimore's proprietorship. In 1692, the General Assembly, now under a royal governor, Lionel Copley, established the Church of England as the official Church of Maryland. In 1704, it went further. It restricted the exercise of the Catholic sacraments, prohibited Catholics from operating schools, limited the corporate ownership of property to hamper religious orders, and encouraged the conversion of Catholic children. Catholics closed St. Mary's Chapel and reused the bricks for a manor house on the safer ground of the St. Inigo's plantation. In fact, by the mid-18th century, the African slave trade and African slavery were transforming the social boundaries and intellectual culture of British North America. In fact, at the height of anti-Catholicism, the slave trade was basically remapping the American colonies. One way of measuring that is the academic revolution that occurred in the colonies at the very moment that the slave trade peaked. In the less than 25 years, less than a quarter century, merchants and planters funded new denominational schools throughout North America. In 1745, Anglicans in Barbados organized Codrington College, the only advanced school in the English Caribbean. The following year, Presbyterians chartered the College of New Jersey, now Princeton. About 1749, Anglicans, Presbyterians, and Quakers combined to establish the College of Philadelphia, now the University of Pennsylvania. And I said about 1749 on purpose because I'll leave that debate to the people who went to Penn. Those who went to Columbia know still actually often use Penn's later founding date, 1755. But I won't actually get into that either. In 1754, the governing Anglican minority in New York City organized King's College, now Columbia. A decade later, in 1764, Baptists founded the College of Rhode Island, now Brown University. In 1766, the Dutch Reformed leadership in New Jersey opened Queen's College, now Rutgers, having decided to remain separate from the Presbyterian venture in the colony. In 1769, New Hampshire granted a charter to the Congregationalist minister Eleazar Wheelock, who founded Dartmouth College that year. Commerce actually loosened the sectarian boundaries of these colonial institutions. One way of seeing this is actually by looking at the changing status of Jewish students on colonial campuses. Jewish families had actually used tutors in small private academies to educate their children. But by the mid-18th century, they were gaining access to colonial colleges. Donations from the slave traders Jacob Rodriguez de Rivera and Aaron Lopez of Newport, Rhode Island, and the planter and merchant Moses Lindo of Charleston, South Carolina, led the trustees of the College of Rhode Island, now Brown, to admit its first Jewish students. The colleges in New York City and Philadelphia, where Jewish merchant families had gained some acceptance, also began admitting Jewish students. Catholics, in contrast, had no college in the British colonies. Ordered priests ran small academies and sent privileged youth from the American plantations abroad to complete their educations. A number of colleges in continental Europe specialized in training English and colonial Catholics. Families in the British colonies, in fact, routinely bypassed the older colleges in New Spain, particularly in Mexico, the Dominican Republic, where the first college in the Americas is in the Dominican Republic. It's still there. It's the Autonomous University in Santo Domingo. But they routinely bypassed the older colleges in New Spain and the somewhat older colleges in New France for these European schools. The cousins, who I mentioned earlier, John and Charles Carroll, studied at the somewhat clandestine preparatory school that the Jesuits ran on the Bohemia Manor plantation in Maryland. Eleanor and Daniel Carroll then sent their son John to the College of Saint-Omer, founded in 1593 in northern France. Elizabeth and Charles Carroll of DeRagon, Maryland, enrolled their Charlie at the College of Reims, founded in 1578. Robert Plunkett and Robert Molyneux, the first two presidents of Georgetown, journeyed from England, where Catholic education had been suppressed, to the seminaries at Wotton and Douai, respectively. The young Louis-Guillaume Valentin de Bourg, Georgetown's third president, left Cap François Saint-Domingue, now Cap Haitien Haiti, to attend Saint-Omer. Another future president of the college, Stephen Dubuisson, sailed as a boy from Saint-Marc, the major western coastal city of Saint-Domingue, to study in France. Quote, "I shall never be able to repay the care and pains you have taken of my education," Charlie Carroll wrote to his father, his dear papa, from London, while studying law at the Inner Temple. African slavery, in fact, afforded affluent Catholics significant personal freedom. Quote, "I shall keep my estate in and nigh Annapolis, two large seats of land containing each about 13,000 acres, my slaves and the Baltimore ironworks to ye last, so you may choose," Carroll of DeRagon promised his son. The family estate neighbored those of a number of wealthy plantation and merchant families, including the final generation of Quaker slave owners, such as the elder Johns Hopkins. By the 18th century, the English Jesuits, in fact, owned plantations that reached from the northeast border between Maryland and Pennsylvania, and Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, to the southwest boundary with Virginia. As noted earlier, in 1637, the Jesuits received St. Inigo's, which comprised 2,000 mainland acres and 1,000 acres on St. George Island. In the summer of 1640, William Britton was granted the lands that became the Newtown Plantation. In February 1670, the Reverend Henry Pelham acquired 4,000 acres along the Potomac near Port Tobacco, where the order built St. Thomas Manor. By the 18th century, the Jesuit estates comprised more than 14,000 acres in Maryland, spread across the colony, 2,000 acres in Pennsylvania, and small parcels in other colonies. The importance of slavery to the Catholic missions was obvious even to visitors. Quote, 10,000 acres of the best ground in Maryland forms at this hour part of the property of the Jesuits, complained Patrick Smythe, an Irish priest who spent several months in Maryland and then published a treatise that accused the clergy of abusing enslaved people to support profligacy. There was ample evidence to support that accusation. Granny Suckey, a 96-year-old enslaved woman, recalled being beaten as a child in the mid-18th century by Father John Bolton at St. Inigo's after she interrupted his self-flagellation. Violence was not the only form of abuse. Child mortality was high at St. Inigo's and the other Jesuit plantations. During the 25-year period ending in 1780, when Jesuit Superior George Hunter resided at St. Thomas Manor, only 26 of the 48 black children born on the plantation survived to maturity. The Jesuits, quote, "have a prodigious number of Negroes, and these sooty rogues will not work unless they be goaded and whipped and almost slayed alive," Smythe charged. John Carroll vigorously denied those allegations, accusing Smythe of pursuing a personal vendetta. But just a few years earlier, Carroll had actually confessed to the general neglect of the slaves, an admission that he repeated for much of his career. Charles Carroll of DeRagon was no less dependent upon slavery, and he had taught his son the business of plantation management and manufacturing, which included lessons on the application of violence. The Carrolls used enslaved black laborers on their estates and at the ironworks, for which they also purchased European indentured servants. The younger Carroll served as his family's business representative while he was in Europe studying, and upon his return to America took control of a share of the lands and more than 300 human beings. Quote, two of them have been well whipped, he assured his father after hiring a new overseer, and quoting again, and Will shall have a severe whipping tomorrow. They are now quite quelled. The American Revolution, in fact, fundamentally changed the place of Catholics in North America, particularly in British North America, English North America. For a war between the Protestant King of Great Britain and his Protestant colonies, the American Revolution was a strikingly Catholic affair. Several French Catholic general officers advised George Washington and the new United States government, devised military strategies, and even commanded colonial troops. That group included the Counts Rochambeau, Lafayette, Beauvoir, Gabriel. I won't name them all because their names are actually eight words each. Casimir Pulaski, a Polish Catholic, raised the cavalry for the colonial army. Thaddeus Kosciuszko, also Polish and Catholic, served as the American army's chief engineer. The French and Spanish crowns had given covert support to the American cause from its earliest stages. The colonists negotiated with Spain through the embassy in Paris, and Lafayette returned to Paris to urge direct French military involvement in the American uprising. Spain attacked Britain's interest in South America and smuggled supplies to the colonists across the Allegheny Mountains. In 1778, France officially recognized the United States, and the following year, Spain declared war on Great Britain. In the summer of 1780, 46 French vessels carrying more than 12,000 soldiers and sailors landed in New England. Foreign forces were decisive in the final American campaign, which brought the October 1781 surrender of the British General Charles Cornwallis at Yorktown. The Spanish naval officer, Francisco de Cervera, served under de Grasse, raised money in Cuba and Santo Domingo for the offensive, and helped design the campaign. It was General Washington and three French officers, Rochambeau, Barras, and de Grasse, who signed the October 19, 1781 capitulation on behalf of the victorious United States. Quote, long live the King of France, therefore I have to suggest, ranks among the more noteworthy chants of a colonial army that had acquired its military experience in wars against the French army. Anti-Catholic and anti-French sentiments had even intensified the conflict between the colonies and England. In 1774, Parliament granted religious freedom to Catholics in eastern Canada, which Britain took by treaty at the end of the French and Indian War, outraging the radical Protestants of the lower colonies, where a century and a half of tension and war militated against so cavalier an extension of tolerance. South Carolina reacted with a law to disarm, quote, Catholics, Negroes, and Indians. The following year, General Benedict Arnold's army failed in an invasion of Quebec and Montreal. The colonial government then followed that disaster with a gesture at diplomacy, authorizing Benjamin Franklin and Samuel Chase of Maryland to become a delegation with two Catholics, the Reverend John Carroll and Charles Carroll of Carrollton, to Eastern Canada to try and first repair the damage, and then woo the French Catholics into the war against England. Realizing the fate of that venture, Franklin abandoned the group before they even reached Quebec. At the outbreak of the American Revolution, Charles Carroll could not vote. He couldn't hold public office, and he couldn't serve in the militia in Maryland. He was quite wealthy, but he was Catholic. And anti-Catholicism actually defined his reality. His co-religionists from Georgia to New Hampshire also faced restrictions on their civil and religious freedom. Carroll was a strident defender of political freedom who described the tendencies of tyranny. In the pages of the same colonial newspaper that had run advertisements for his family's runaway slaves, a century and a half of religious persecution had prepared him and many Catholics to articulate the advantages of constitutional government. However, when he journeyed to the Continental Congress, he came not as a member, but as a mere advisor to the Maryland delegation. In July 1776, Carroll of Carrollton became the only Catholic signer of the Declaration of Independence. And only in Maryland, a month later, did Marylanders, I'm sorry, only in August, a month later, did Marylanders finally again affirm the right to the free exercise of religion for professing Christians. The relationship between the United States and the Catholic world changed dramatically in the following months. Benjamin Franklin sailed for Paris to serve as ambassador to the court of Louis XVI. Congress sent James Jay of New York and Arthur Lee of Virginia to plead its cause before the Spanish crown. Far more surprising, in September 1777, it authorized Ralph Izard of South Carolina to appeal for funds and support in Italy, the heart of the Catholic world, where there was significant interest in the rebellion. The rise of the Catholic Church in the United States occurred parallel to the reestablishment of plantation slavery after the war. In 1783, as the British evacuation continued, John Carroll called the clergy to White Marsh Plantation to draft a governing structure for the church, the Catholic Church. The Corporation of Roman Catholic Clergy, created by an act of Maryland General Assembly in 1792, also governed its financial affairs, including taking ownership of the plantations. The English invasion had disrupted slavery in much of the state, and enemy troops had ransacked Newtown Manor, one of the oldest Jesuit properties. The British Navy had blockaded the Chesapeake and the lower Potomac, empowering thousands of black people to escape the plantations around St. Mary's County and Port Tobacco. In 1784, Father James Walton did something significant that actually marked, in some ways, the return of the Catholic Church and the return of slavery in the United States. He ordered the slaves at St. Inigo's to begin raising a new church. The following year, John Carroll laid the cornerstone, and Father Francis Neal, later another president of the college, dedicated the structure. In April 1789, George Washington was inaugurated in New York City. That same month, riots broke out in Paris. And by the summer, France was in the throes of revolution. After mobs stormed the Bastille on July 14, 1789, to seize ammunition and powder, the Marquis de Lafayette took the key to the breached prison and sent it as a souvenir to his friend and ally, George Washington. That same year, Pope Pius VI, who rejected French revolutionary attempts to rein in the authority of the church in France, established a diocese in the new United States that became a refuge for French clerics. Encouraged by Benjamin Franklin, the Vatican also named John Carroll bishop of the new American church. Carroll led the ex-Jesuits and the Sulpicians in opening Georgetown officially that year, although he had been planning it for several years. The coming of the French and Creole exiles, the refugees of the French Revolution and the revolution in Saint-Domingue, now Haiti, allowed Bishop Carroll to institutionalize the Catholic Church in the United States through a network of colleges and seminaries. After opening Georgetown, Carroll turned his attention to helping the Sulpicians organize a seminary. The anti-church and anti-clerical thrust of the French Revolution had threatened the order's Parisian Academy, and the Sulpicians began raising money for an American school and recruiting continental European students to come to Maryland. In 1791, as the first class was entering Georgetown, the French priests opened St. Mary's. Quote, "All our hopes are founded on the Seminary of Baltimore," John Carroll declared. The seminary made Maryland a center for Catholic theology, raised the intellectual culture of the communion, and turned Baltimore into a destination for clerics fleeing the Atlantic revolutions. In 1792, Bishop Carroll dispatched a group of Dominicans, the Order of Preachers, who had come to Maryland as refugees to the rapidly growing region of Kentucky. Georgetown was itself a product of the Atlantic Revolution. Social and economic ties to the Catholic empires made it probably the most diverse campus in the early United States. Emigres from revolutionary France and revolutionary Saint-Domingue filled the faculty and the student body. Most of the students at Georgetown in its first decade are from Virginia and Maryland. They dominate. But there's a significant international presence in those early classes. The first class included, for instance, Francois and Antoine Casse, and students from France, Madeira, Martinique, St. Lucia, Guadeloupe, Cuba, St. John, and Santo Domingo enrolled in the following years. By 1798, Georgetown, I believe, is the only college in the United States that's publishing its prospectus in English, French, and Spanish. The earliest presidents included Fathers Dubourg and Dubuisson, both born to Creole slaveholding families in Saint-Domingue, now Haiti. Dubourg had even traveled to Cuba, to Havana, to open a college. And when he failed at that effort, he began recruiting the children of planters in Cuba to St. Mary's Seminary and later St. Mary's College. Quote, "To American commerce, may it ever derive greater pride from the distress it has relieved than from the wealth it has accumulated. The guest at a party, a festival, toasted on the evening of January 9, 1809. Quote, "The concourse of French and American ladies and gentlemen was numerous and brilliant," the Maryland Gazette reported. "Creoles from Saint-Domingue came to honor the West Indies trader Duncan McIntosh and other merchants and captains who risked their vessels and money running rescue missions to Saint-Domingue, to Haiti. A Creole himself, Father Dubourg, the former president of Georgetown and founder of St. Mary's Seminary, presented McIntosh with an award for his humanitarianism. Slavery allowed for the immediate incorporation of those Atlantic refugees, including the early presidents of Georgetown. Bishop Carroll and the Corporation of Roman Catholic Clergy, for instance, assigned the Bohemia Manor Plantation, one of the plantations, to the Sulpicians. They actually sort of just given it, to hold rather than to own. But Bohemia Manor was the mechanism through which the Sulpicians then actually funded the establishment of the seminary, right, by running the plantation. Quote, "That the managers of St. Thomas Plantation be allowed the sum of £75, for a Negro boy called Alexis in the service of the bishop," reads the March 1797 minutes of the corporation. "The clergy also voted to sell off a piece of land to provide $4,000 to complete Georgetown. The college and the seminary, like the plantations and the slaves, were part of a package of properties that the Catholic Church owned and managed. In the late summer 1799, the Sulpicians actually wrote back to the clergy, to the corporation, and complained that they had actually been at Bohemia Manor for several years and made, in fact, significant improvements to the property and to the house. And what they wanted was to be compensated with, quote, "the young Negro girl called Peg, the small boy called Jack, both now in service of the seminary, and another boy also called Jack, now in the service of Reverend Marischal at Bohemia." Reverend Marischal was the philosophy professor at Georgetown and at the seminary. A few months later, the clergy voted to allow the Sulpicians to keep Jack and Peg, quote, "as long as they retain said Negroes in the seminary." The clergy also used enslaved people to balance their accounts, including the liabilities of the college, which was tuition-free during its first 40 years. In October 1799, for example, they approved the sale of, quote, "Kate and her two children now belonging to Bohemia Estate." A couple of years later, John Ashton demanded, quote, "ye boy Davy, Simon's son and now motherless, to satisfy a debt that one of the plantations owed him." Quote, "whereas permission was heretofore granted for two slaves of the estate of Bohemia to be sold for the benefit of Georgetown College," end quote, began a March 1808 inquiry from the trustees. The treatment of enslaved people on the Jesuit plantations was equally alarming. After the restoration of the Society of Jesus, after it's no longer suppressed, the Jesuit brothers began actually managing the plantations. They became the primary supervisors. Quote, "some years ago, blacks were more easily kept in due subordination and were more patient under the rod of correction than they are now. Because then discipline flourished, but now it is going to decay," complained Brother Joseph Moberly, a supervisor of the St. Inigo's plantation. I'll quote again. "The present white generation seems to lose sight of the old observation, the better a Negro is treated, the worse he becomes." Brother Moberly had hired five overseers in the four-year period beginning 1816. He acted also as the plantation doctor and only rarely called a physician. In fact, he only called him for dire emergencies. The frequency of slave sales from the Jesuit plantations hinted at, in fact, the deteriorating conditions and management of the Jesuit farms. In 1820, the Irish priest Peter Kenny, official visitor to the Maryland province, documented an awful state of affairs. The supervisors were providing insufficient rations to slaves, overworking servants, and inflicting what Kenny described as excessive violence upon enslaved men and women. Father Kenny particularly condemned the practices of tying up women and beating them, quote, in the priest-owned parlor, which is very indecorous. And he complained that they were whipping pregnant women. There was little attention being paid to the spiritual lives of servants, and Kenny suggested that the Jesuits get out of the business of slaveholding altogether. That suggestion eventually gets taken, not directly, but for other reasons. In 1832, Georgetown's officers in the Corporation of Roman Catholic Clergy conceded that the college actually had to impose tuition, finally, a decision that also accelerated the discussion of dissolving the Maryland slaveholdings. Peter Kenny had repeatedly warned that slaveholding was injuring the public reputation of the Catholic Church. More than a decade earlier, Father Kenny had suggested that the Maryland province begin employing free white people on the farms or just leasing out their lands and collecting rents. The corporation had been selling slaves with increasing frequency as the profitability of the plantations eroded. Financial concerns rather than moral considerations brought an end to slaveholding in the Maryland province. The order had been violating agreements, its own agreements, to maintain families and find suitable Christian masters for years. It was now seeking bids on hundreds of human beings and apparently even attempted to sell the whole group to the Missouri Jesuits. In June 1838, the provincial and former Georgetown president Thomas Maletti contracted for the sale of 272 men, women, and children to Henry Johnson, a Catholic, and the former governor of Louisiana for $115,000. Beginning that fall, the Jesuits shipped their slaves to Louisiana in three cargoes. That wasn't the end of the story of American Catholics and American slavery, or the role that slavery played in the rise of Catholic higher education. Clergy trained in the Maryland province migrated across the nation to build the Catholic Church. The Belgian and some French Jesuits headed west, particularly after the Louisiana Purchase, to help build the Missouri province. And one of the things they build is the first college west of the Mississippi River, which is St. Louis University, a Jesuit college in St. Louis. In 1843, Thomas Maletti, who had contracted the sale of the slaves from Maryland, became the charter president of Holy Cross, the first Catholic college in New England. John Du Bois left St. Mary's to become the Bishop of New York, and then he was succeeded in that position by one of his most famous students, the young Irish immigrant John Hughes, who had paid his tuition at St. Mary's by supervising servants in the college gardens, an arrangement that he made with President Du Bois. In 1843, Bishop Hughes founded Fordham University, the first Jesuit college in New York City, and the home of the regional seminary. John McElroy departed from Maryland and later founded Boston College. The hierarchy of the Catholic Church and the corporate structure of the religious orders render Catholic slaveholding more transparent, but it's important to remember that slavery provided the economic foundation for higher education throughout colonial America. The Catholic orders in Maryland incubated the Catholic Church's engagement with slavery. They provided the outlines for Catholic opposition to abolitionism, and they authored the Church's early moral defenses of human bondage. But the story of American slavery and American higher education is greater than the story of the rise of Catholic institutions. In fact, ultimately, higher education in the United States traces itself to African slavery and the African slave trade. Thank you.
Thanks so very much for this really insightful and very revealing overview and connecting slavery, Catholicism, and U.S. higher education. I think what sort of engaged me most is the connections to the Caribbean. And having just come from Cuba with a group of students and talking to Cubans who are now very stimulated and excited about President Obama's, right, opening, they want that re-engagement. And we were discussing, in fact, the history of America's relationship with Cuba going to the 18th century. and especially 19th century investments, American investments in Cuban slavery. And I wondered, in fact, I never really understood that, in fact, higher education was the route through which that relationship really began because of the, you know, of the Catholics. So can you say something more about that? Because I think it's such an important, because we, when we do American history, we really do not link America to the Caribbean, which in fact, America was part and parcel of, whether it's British, or you look at the Spanish, or the French, the Caribbean, you know, Martinique, Guadeloupe, you know, Saint-Domingue, connected to, you know, to Louisiana, and to other areas, the Spanish, Florida, all of that. And we really, when we do American, especially colonial American history, we just do it from the British point of view and don't even do it that well because the British engagement with both the Spanish and the French. So I would like you to speak a little more on that because I just think it's so relevant.
Sure. There are a few things, a few directions you can go. I gave this talk and I end up picking on Georgetown quite a bit. But you can do this for any college in the United States. You know, the first eight presidents of Princeton are slave owners.
Yes.
One of the first residents of Harvard Yard is an enslaved black man who probably arrives on the first slave ship. The first slave ship that leaves New England brings him back. It's very likely brings him back from the West Indies. He's referred to as the Moor. And he's there just a couple of years after Harvard is founded at Yale. The founders actually arrive at their organizational meeting, followed by their slaves. And so slavery and the American college go hand in hand, and you can do this story for virtually any college in the United States. I chose Georgetown for a few reasons. One is that in this story, the Irish Catholics are the heroes until you get to John Hughes,
yes.
until you get to the very end. Because they're actually the Catholics from Ireland, Catholic priests from Ireland, are the ones recording their outrage about what's happening in the Jesuit plantations in the Americas and what's happening in the Catholic Church in British North America. And so a lot of the evidence that we have, particularly firsthand accounts, actually come from those reports. And they're really quite extraordinarily detailed reports because the visitations go on for years. These aren't short visits. They're in residence for years. When you come to the Caribbean, you know, there's that moment that I talked about, you know, fewer than 25 years, when the number of colleges in British North America more than triples from 3 to 10. Right? And in that 24-year period where that happens, beginning with Condrington in Barbados and ending with, actually perfectly, actually, because it's the southernmost and the northernmost, with Dartmouth in New Hampshire, in that period, that's when the slave trade is peaking. But what's sustaining those new schools is their relationship to slavery and the slave trade. Condrington is a grant from General Christopher Codrington, who commanded the forces in the Leeward Islands and who leaves in his will plantations to support, right, slave plantations where the funds, the monies, will support a college that he wants to establish in Barbados. It takes another 30-something years for them to finally do it. But he also leaves plantations to support the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel, and Oxford, where he had attended school. And so when you look at the colleges that are established in that, you know, quarter century, they're established with very close connections to the West Indies. You know, Princeton, the College of New Jersey, is a struggling college for its first 20 years. And it's rescued, stabilized, when they managed to recruit the Reverend John Witherspoon from Scotland to Princeton, a Scottish Presbyterian school, an evangelical school. But how does Witherspoon stabilize Princeton? He stabilizes it by basically tracing the Scottish diaspora in the Americas, and particularly into the South and into the West Indies. And so he follows the plantations, and he immediately begins going on fundraising tours southward. You know, South Carolina actually becomes a major source of support for the Princeton College, but he also sends a missive to the West Indians, basically declaring that the very name, and I think I'm quoting this properly, the very name of a West Indian has come to imply great opulence. And in that missive, he argues that, in fact, it's not great for wealthy planters from the Caribbean to send their sons to England to be educated, because in London, everyone knows West Indians are wealthy, and unscrupulous people will prey upon them. But if you send them to Princeton, they'll be taken care of and shepherded into adulthood. And they'll be close enough. It's actually a very modern appeal. They'll be close enough where you can come and visit them, but far enough away that they can't run home and become idle. Without the slavery parts, you could actually reprint it now. The West Indies are critical to actually establishing this. At Dartmouth, Eleazar Wheelock takes on a man who's often referred to as his first black student. And I don't want to get into that business because it's actually a kind of messy thing to try and figure out. But the 18th century black students who study with college presidents, whether or not you count them as actual students is a tough one. But at Dartmouth, I think it shows exactly why it's so difficult. Eleazar Wheelock takes on a black student for the purpose of actually giving him a Christian education and becoming a minister. The student actually isn't a matriculated student. He isn't a student. He's someone being tutored directly by the president. But one of the reasons why Wheelock is interested in him is that he wants to send him to the West Indies. And he initially wants to train him, literally, to go south and be a minister with the hope that a black minister will help to keep enslaved people from rebelling. But using Occam as a kind of model, if you think about Wheelock's first black student, he eventually decides that it would really be helpful to send him to the West Indies as an ambassador for Dartmouth. And recruiting wealthy students, colleges survive in the colonial world by finding sources of students and wealth. And those sources are actually the West Indies. The wealthiest people in British North America are in Barbados. Those of us who do colonial and early national history, the 13 colonies aren't the 13 colonies until the war breaks out. Right? Up until that moment, New York has intimate ties to Jamaica and Barbados. Massachusetts is, the Harvard historian Samuel Eliot Morrison once pointed out, it's Barbados that saves New England, right? That it's the establishment of a trade to Barbados that allows the Puritans to survive the first decades of their arrival in the Americas. And so the Caribbean plays a key role in all of these institutions. And you can see it over and over again. In the book, I point out, after Columbia is established, King's College in New York, the trustees run multiple campaigns to the West Indies. They immediately start looking for an ambassador to raise money in the West Indies.
Thank you very much. Fascinating talk. I wonder at what point in history is this connection no longer a vital one, and what are the historical elements that made that possible? I'm just intrigued that when did colleges no longer, when can you no longer really see a viable connection to the shadows of slavery?
Okay.
Although you can make a case that perhaps
you can see it now. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
But
yeah.
You know
in the building names. Yeah, you just have to go look at the building names, right? And it's like street names in the East Coast. It's a rolling monument to slave owners and slave traders. The answer is 1865. Right, the connection ends with the end of the Civil War, because if you think about, for instance, let's pick on Harvard for a little while, we'll pick on Protestants for a while and give Catholics a break. If you think about Harvard for a bit, Harvard's connection to slavery begins with the beginning of Harvard. Right, within a couple of years of getting the charter, there's an intimate, close tie to the development of slave trading out of New England, which, remember, is actually the first enslaved people sold out of New England are Native Americans, conquered in war. And then so they're actually the survivors of the Pequot Massacre are the enslaved people who are sold into Bermuda and the West Indies. And that ship, the Desire, returns probably to Boston. It leaves from Marblehead, but I think it looks like it returns to Boston. It returns with numerous commodities, including black people, right? And Harvard gets its first slave that very same year, the year that the ship returned. So it's very likely that he comes from that. Right? After that, in fact, the relationship between the college and slavery grows rapidly and significantly. First, Harvard's, New England's economic ties to the West Indies continue to develop. Harvard becomes, in fact, one of the institutions that trains and supplies the southern plantations, Virginia, the Carolinas, and then later Georgia, with trained ministers and trained professionals for government, et cetera, merchants, et cetera. And they supply the West Indies in a similar way. And so there's a flow of young men leaving the college and looking to begin their careers in the West Indies and the South, beginning in the 17th century and continuing through the 18th century. The direct economic ties, remember, we're recruiting students in the West Indies. We're looking for donors and financial support from West Indian planters. We're sending campaigns, fundraising campaigns to southern plantations and to the West Indies. And when slavery finally ends in Massachusetts in the 1780s, and ends largely by what today might get described as an activist court, putting an end to slavery in Massachusetts, the ties between the college and slavery survive. Because by that time, Harvard's fate, the sociology and institutional structure of the school is actually wound up with the slave regimes of the South and the West Indies in direct ways. And so, as late as the late 19th century, Harvard is being given a plantation in Cuba that it uses for some of its scientific research. That tie continues. And so it's not really until the end of slavery as a consequence of the American Civil War, but then ultimately as the end of slavery in the Americas, that the ties between American colleges and American slavery are finally severed.
So I'm really pleased to see the group that turned out today. This is a very exciting moment, and I'm glad to see that everybody was very enthusiastic about our program today. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Craig Wilder, professor of history at MIT. Professor Wilder's lecture was titled Slavery, Conquest, and the Rise of the American College, and was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Tonight's moderator was African American Studies Program Director John Thornton. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 800-909-9287. That's 800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Paul Kalo. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.